Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Today is our final program featuring the instructors panel and our favorite scenes from Hamlet. So let's just jump right into part three. Well, we're back, and for our last scene in our discussion of this segment is we're going to introduce James, who is a Brandon. And James, let's talk about your favorite scene.
Thank you. The second Brandon in this room. My favorite scene has been alluded to multiple times. I think we saved the best for last. So Act 5, Scene 1. It's towards the end of the book. Things are finally starting to come to a head at this point. Before I even talk about the scene, I'll just say kind of why it's my favorite scene. Hamlet was the first bit of Shakespeare that I ever read. And I didn't really understand it. And honestly, I was a little bit prejudiced against Hamlet. Or not Hamlet, but a little bit prejudiced against Shakespeare, as I think probably any, like, you know, 13 or 14 year old might be. And, you know, I had to read this book. So I was forced to go through it. And I found myself enjoying it, but then I got to this scene and realized that Shakespeare could actually be really funny. I think that there's humor throughout Hamlet. I think it culminates in this scene, or at least for me, it resonated in this scene where I read this and I just thought it was hilarious. It probably started with the fact that most versions start with "Enter two clowns," and I didn't know what a clown meant. You know, I now know that that is basically just referring to any sort of lower class citizen or something like that. But in my, you know, naivety, my introduction to Shakespeare, "Enter two clowns," I'm like, we're in the middle of this dark tragedy with these horrible lies, and then all of a sudden there's this scene.
Fuzzy,
yeah,
red fuzzy hair these, with a big red nose
and they're grave diggers too. So I think the comedy for me was immediately set up with that.
That was
scene
a favorite
setting.
Epithet of my dad, by the way. If he didn't like anybody, he says, "Oh, they're clowns." You know, so sorry,
no,
sorry for interrupting you.
No, so I think that just has always stuck in my memory, and I think that's kind of the basis for why this is my favorite scene. Obviously, there's a lot more to it than that. There's a lot of great stuff in here. This scene is really a lot of dark comedy, which I suppose is not everybody's forte, but this is kind of a tragic history. So any comedy that we insert in here, that Shakespeare inserted in here, is probably going to be dark. Spoiler alert, at the beginning of immediately previous to this scene, Ophelia has drowned. So she's dead. That's sort of the scene setting leading into this scene. She dies and everybody says, you know, Laertes is upset. Everybody's upset. And then that scene cuts and then it heads straight into these grave digging clowns. And they're digging a grave for Ophelia. And they have this little conversation back and forth to each other. So this is the first one. He starts off and he says, "Is she to be buried in Christian burial when she willfully seeks her own salvation?" The other one replies, "I tell thee she is. Therefore make her grave straight. The crowner hath sat on her and finds it Christian burial." So this Shakespeare delves into some pretty touchy subjects here. And in the last discussion, he talked about religion, and I think he does touch on that in this scene. These gravediggers are basically saying, well, she killed herself, didn't she? So why are we burying her? You know, that was not considered appropriate for, you know, somebody that had taken their own life.
Yeah, I think if we get into the technicalities of Catholicism, I think if I remember correctly, now, I mean, it's been a long time since I've, you know, attended, but it was my impression as a young altar boy, which I was, that if someone committed suicide, they didn't get a mass. You know, they just got buried. And I think that's what they're talking about here is, does she deserve a Christian burial if she commits suicide? And like I said, I don't want to disparage Catholics and their theology, but I think that's what Shakespeare is referring to here.
Right. So she gets, and you can see that earlier in the scene, that she gets all the sort of everything that accompanied, you know, a proper Christian burial she had. And these gravediggers were a little bit confused by that. And this, I think that the comedy really starts with that, the first gravedigger. I keep wanting to call him a clown. Where he says to his friend, like, okay, give me leave. I'm going to explain this to you. Here's what we're looking at. Here lies the water, and you can sort of picture them acting this out. Here lies the water, good. Here stands the man, good. If the man go to this water and drown himself, it is, will he, nil he goes, mark you that. But if the water come to him and drown him, he drowns not himself. Argal, he that is not guilty of his own death shortens not his own life. You know, just a comical explanation there of, well, if you go into the water, then that's you taking your own life. But if you're here and then the water comes to you, obviously, you know, that's not your fault. So
it's a didactic argument.
Yeah, and there's plenty of that throughout here. There's another funny bit here, just a few lines down from that, where he's telling there's one dominant gravedigger that kind of verbally abuses the other one. And he says, I'll just cut into the thought here. He says, come my spade, there is no ancient gentleman but gardeners, ditchers, and grave makers. They hold up Adam's profession. And his friend replies, was he a gentleman? And the first one says, he was the first one that ever bore arms. And he's, you know, a little bit of double meaning here. And the other says, what? He had none. You know, saying that he didn't have a coat of arms. And then the other clown, or the other gravedigger, says, what, are you a heathen? How do you understand the scripture? The scripture says, Adam digged. Could he dig without arms? I'll put another question to you. If you answer me not to your purpose, confess yourself. So you get a taste of the humor of this one gravedigger. He really just sort of holds you to exactly what the words mean. So there's another instance of that where Hamlet has entered the scene at this point, and he's talking to that gravedigger, and he says, who do you dig this grave for? And he says, for no man, sir. Well, what woman then? For none either. Well, then who is going to be buried in it? One that was a woman, sir, but rest her soul, she's dead. And Hamlet says, how absolute the knave is. We must speak by the card or equivocation will undo us. Where he says by the card there, that is just referring to like a geographer's compass that had, I think, like 32 points or something on it. So very, not even just four directions, north, south, east, and west, but a very specific set of directions. So you can kind of see, you know, the humor in that as well. But then this deals with a lot of serious subjects as well. When the funeral procession comes in, I think that you see Hamlet has real grief. I don't think it was part of his plan to sort of jump out and confront Laertes, but he winds up, you know, at the end of the scene, you know, jumping out, scuffling with Laertes inside the grave of Ophelia. It's just this really sort of tragically comical scene where there's like these two little boys fighting over something. You know, they both are arguing who loved her the most. I think they both embarrass themselves quite a lot and they have to be separated. But Shakespeare, I think, uses this to really deal with some of the harsher subjects. You know, Hamlet is just preoccupied with death and human mortality and the afterlife, like has been mentioned. You know, these things really plagued him. And I think all of those elements are in here. I know that multiple people have thoughts about different aspects of this scene, so I'll cede the floor.
Oh, I just the great, wonderful humor in here that, he even makes fun of the English towards right after the area there where you talked about him being having to speak by the card about probably 10-15 lines down. He says, it was the same day Hamlet, this is the gravedigger, was born, he that is mad and sent to England. And Hamlet says, aye, Mary, why was he sent to England? And the gravedigger says, why, because he was mad. He shall recover his wits there, or if he do not, 'tis no great matter there. Hamlet says, why? He says, 'twill not be seen in him there. There the men are as mad as he. So you got to dig at your own countrymen, I guess. And then he starts talking about how long a tanner's body will last in the grave. It's all very dark humor, but he, but like you said, they do start exploring some pretty deep stuff, especially when he picks out Yorick's skull, which was one of the men in the court that kind of raised Hamlet, I guess, or at least knew him when he was young. And I think we all agree this is definitely one of the more entertaining, but also the mixture of entertainment and depth that the subjects that you suddenly get dropped into. I think one of the great directors, I haven't seen a lot of his films, but I know, I think it was Alfred Hitchcock wrote that you have to give people a little bit of humor if you're going to scare them or do anything else. You can't just have everything be heavy. And so when I think Shakespeare understood that, and he gets you off balance a little bit with all of this back and forth, and then suddenly you're contemplating the afterlife, as we already discussed.
Really, I think this scene is set up as a parallel to the to be or not to be soliloquy, that you have the ideas that are expressed there as to be or not to be, and then you get this absurd parallel to it that is the will he, nil he soliloquy of sorts. I mean, to be or not to be, will he, nil he. It's all very similar. And Mr. Leap wrote an article about the to be or not to be soliloquy, and the illustration that he put at the top of it was Yorick's skull, because these two things are just so intimately tied together. This style of writing that Shakespeare used in Act 5, Scene 1, I think he inadvertently gave rise to an entire category of play that came in the 1950s, 1960s, which was the theater of the absurd. Probably the first one you would have heard of was Waiting for Godot. The idea behind these plays was that you had these philosophical musings back and forth, but they were also absurd. A later one I mentioned earlier, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. I mean, this entire idea of philosophical talk that really isn't sensible, it originated with things that started in Hamlet.
I think that one of the things that I think is really important, that Shakespeare did intend this to be comedic, and there's no doubt about that. And I mean, what we're heading into is, you know, how many people are dead in that last scene? You know, I mean, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, I mean, I'm not talking about the play now, but they are dead, you know. Mm-hmm. Hamlet reverses the letters. They were supposed to get Hamlet dead, and then Hamlet reverses the letters, and they end up dead. So they're already dead before this scene even happens. So we know Laertes dies, we know Gertrude dies, we know Claudius dies, we know Hamlet dies, we know Osric dies, you know. And so I think Shakespeare is getting us ready with a little bit of a comedic scene before you go through all the intensity. Now, it to me, when I saw the Branagh film, it didn't affect me as intensely as I did when I saw it live. And I did see it over. I saw it twice, and I saw it once before I interviewed the two actors, and I saw it a second time after I interviewed the two actors, and I actually got a personal connection with the actors. So when they were acting, it's kind of like really drew me into it. And the final scene is, I mean, it's just really kind of gut-wrenching if you're really into it. And I think Shakespeare's audiences were. But I think there's also some things in this scene that we don't want to miss. And, you know, I brought this up before when we were talking about, you know, just the movement in the play, and that you know, a lot of people ask, well, why doesn't Hamlet, you know, why isn't he king? In other words, if you put this in the context like Mark was talking about anachronisms, I mean, it's very English. It's an English play, even though it's set in Elsinore, and even though they're Danes. I mean, Shakespeare really is dealing with England. He uses the word pound. He uses those kind of anachronisms in it, but I do think there's something here that you can miss with Yorick. And one of the things I think is it's really a very interesting paper I read about the succession. You know, the English were just totally absorbed with succession. You know, who the next king was going to be. You had to have a male heir, or, you know, it was just going to be an outrage. But even if you look into the, Mark brought up the Old Testament, even if you look in the Old Testament, you know, even God doesn't follow succession. I mean, when Saul lost the throne, God didn't go to the next son, Saul's son. He just said, I'm going to start all over. And he goes to David. But even when David's ready to die, he still doesn't go to what? The first son. I mean, Absalom tried to take the throne, and he ends up dead by Joab. And then his brother Adonijah tries to take the throne. He ends up dead by the man God chose to take the throne. And so succession is, I wouldn't say that's necessarily a biblical concept. But now, if you're going to inherit property, the oldest son, you know, generally it passed to the oldest son. But then if there's no oldest son, then it did pass to the daughters. So they did change that. But if you look at what happens here, is why did Hamlet not be put on the throne? And he does make a comment about it. He says, I lack, you know, advancement. He says that to Horatio. But if you look at the very, let's go back, and again, I think you'll see this is all related. If you go back to Act 2, let's go back to that Act 2, in the very first scene, this is where we get our introduction to Claudius, and we get our introduction to Gertrude, Act 2, Scene 1. We're taken in, Branagh leads us to believe this happens right at the, you know, right after their wedding. If you look at Gertrude, she's carrying a bouquet, and then everybody, it's like they throw rice on them. It's Act 1, Scene 2, not Act 2, Scene 2. But notice what Claudius says to Hamlet. He gets upset that Hamlet is, you know, so upset. But at one part of this scene is Claudius does say to Hamlet, you are our son, and you are my replacement. And so Claudius actually identifies Hamlet as the replacement for the throne. But if you look at it, what this paper does bring out, and according to the College of Electors in Denmark, if the father had identified that the son would be the next king, Hamlet would have been king. But Hamlet's father didn't even do that, and that's why they chose Claudius. And again, you know, there was a problem between Hamlet and his father, and I think that's what that paper shows out, because here's Claudius is saying, okay, you are my replacement. And that would be like Act 1, Scene 2, where you can find that. And but notice back here in this Scene 1 of Act 5, this is around, well, page 128 in the Pelican, and it's around line 172. Hamlet says, ah, alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy. He hath bore me on his back 1,000 times, and now how abhorrent my imagination it is, my gorge rises at it. Here hung those lips that I have kissed I know not how oft. Where be your jibes now, you gambols, you songs, your flashes of merriment that were wont to set the table on a roar? Not one now to mock your own grinning. Quite chopfallen, now get you to my lady's table and tell her, let her paint an inch thick to this favor she must come. Make her laugh at that. Prithee, Horatio, tell me one thing. And so if you look at this line, this is in the gravedigger scene, and of course he's holding, you know, Yorick's skull, and that's just a classic way to portray Hamlet. If you look at all the artwork, you know, they have of Hamlet, he's holding this, you know, this skull. Even the Royal Shakespeare Company sells crystal skulls that you could, you know, for £200 take home if you want to spend £200. But notice, if you really look at those lines and study them, it just seems to me that Hamlet had a closer relationship with Yorick than he did with his own dad. You know, if you look at, you know, the way he approaches things, you know, could it be that maybe Hamlet, you know, he could have had respect for his father, but maybe he wasn't as close to father as he was, and maybe even in the long run, that's why he doesn't act as fast as he could. And even the ghost asks him, you know, if you ever loved your father. I mean, he even asked Hamlet that. The ghost asked him that. And so I do think that even in this scene, you know, of course there is, I mean, it is kind of gross where they, you know, where they talk about, you know, maggots crawling all over everybody, and, you know, they just take the bones out, throw them out, put a new body in. I mean, that's what they're doing. They're actually cleaning out a grave. And how many people are in there, you don't know, but they're cleaning it out so they can put Ophelia in. And so I think Hamlet is funny when he does talk about, you know, Alexander, and he talks about Caesar, and he says, what are they, mortar now between bricks? You know, because they, I mean, Shakespeare does know, you know, that we're made from dust. And so he's saying, what are they, mortar between bricks now? And, you know, he talks about, you know, well, don't throw those skulls around. That could have been a lawyer, or that could have been this. You know, here they were, you know, these smart, intellectual people, and you're just throwing their bones around like nothing. So it is a very comedic scene, but also I think there are some serious things in there that can give us some deep insights into, you know, certainly other characters. And what Shakespeare does show us is there does seem to be, when we say that things are rotten in Denmark, it does seem like there's rottenness in everybody's life in the play. There's something wrong with everyone. And so the problem really could have gone, the whole thing with Hamlet and the family could have started with actually Hamlet's father. You know, there's all that, there's debate whether Gertrude really did help kill her husband. But I don't think there's any debate that she had an adulterous affair with his brother. And so, you know, so maybe some of those whole things, all these things are coming out. And here Shakespeare, just in his genius, kind of brings this out between Hamlet and his dad. He brings it out with this whole character of Yorick, who was the court jester for the father. But it sure seems like he spent a lot more time with Yorick than he did with his own dad. So... But I do think it is my favorite scene, especially from the Branagh film, because Billy Crystal is the clown. And he really, when he and the Branagh go at it with each other in the grave, it's hilarious. So, all right. So any other comments? Everybody's been flipping through their books. We've done that actually for having two different versions, three different versions. we haven't done so badly.
I thought I'd point out that towards the end of the play, Act 5, Scene 2, you were talking about the election and everything.
Mm-hmm.
On mine, it's around line 70, but he does talk about, does it not think thee stand me now upon, that he that has killed my king and whored my mother popped in between the election and my hopes, thrown out his angle for my proper life. He does make a reference to the king manipulating, I think, even the election so that he would, Claudius, that is. And I also think it's interesting, and this is probably a tale for another time, but he's come back from England, he's had Rosencrantz and Guildenstern killed, and suddenly it's not about revenge and his mother anymore. He's also kind of more about, he throws in there pretty strongly that it's his place to be the king. It is alluded there in the beginning, you talked about it, but most of it's talking about revenge and his father, and, you know, that the king, and now right before the play ends, we get this other selfish motivation kind of thrown in there. And I think that as the play devolves into everybody dying, spoiler, you kind of have that justification, because Hamlet is not exactly a character by the end of the play that you're rooting for. You know, at the beginning, you're like, oh, this young man has had been wronged, and then at the end of it, you're like, nope, he's just as bad as the rest of them, and then everybody kind of gets what they deserve according to Victorian law. So,
yeah, it is really kind of amazing at the very end. You know, there are some things that it's like even Horatio talks about the mishaps. You know, this is a play. He's going to tell the story, and he says, well, there was a lot of mishaps. There's a lot of bad decisions. I'm just paraphrasing in my own language here. But if you look at the end, I mean, Hamlet does kill Claudius. I mean, he finally gets it over, but Gertrude dies. He also kills Laertes. You know, Osric dies because of Fortinbras. But you know, it is... I think the bottom line of all these scenes, it all leads to the fact is that, you know, human beings make many mistakes, and it can lead to real tragedy. And it's kind of like epic. You know, Shakespeare makes it so epic that you have to take a look at it. But I think all of us can see parts of ourselves in all these characters, and that was really the kind of the backbone of the literary thinkers of Shakespeare's time, that, hey, if we give them good drama, they can hold the mirror up and see themselves. Well, I think we're out of time. And so thanks for coming in today. Appreciate it. Next time, we will be bringing you the 60-plus panel discussion of the characters Gertrude and Ophelia from the play Hamlet. On September 19th, I will bring you my final thoughts on the character Hamlet using his soliloquies. Then on September 26th, we will begin our discussion of Richard III. So if you have not begun reading the play, you should begin to do so now. On October 24th, we will switch gears and begin a discussion on the book 13 Hours, The Inside Account of What Really Happened in Benghazi by Mitchell Zuckoff and the Annex Security Team. This book is a great example of the current history, current issues genre. But remember, a little bit of warning here. The book gives soldier quotes, which do have soldier-type language, which means some off-color language, and the F-bomb word. And I think you all know what that means. If that offends you, you may choose not to read the book, yet you can still listen in on the discussion. And after that, we will be reading a beautiful piece of current fiction titled A Whole Life by Robert Seethaler. Mr. Seethaler is an Australian-born author who has a pleasant but simple writing style. So, there's a lot more to come this year on JBL. I will put this schedule up on the Twitter account. That's JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. I will also feature this schedule on the Facebook page. So, if you have any comments, please write to me at jbl@pcog.org. Until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.